Welcome to Bible Fellowship Church's The Upper Room. Our podcast discusses Sunday messages from Pastor Don, looks at the recent news headlines, and any updates on our congregation and upcoming events. Leading the discussion is our church leadership with invited special guests. We hope you enjoy it and find it informative. To help support our ministry, please consider becoming a subscriber and financial contributor. Links to donate are on our website at bfcforyou.org. Now let's get going. Started. My name is Scott Kimball, and I'm one of the elders here at Bible Fellowship Church. And with us today are Aubrey Kimball.
Hello.
And Dylan Wren.
Hey.
And our engineer today is Andrew Kimball.
Still?
I know I said that like it's different or something, but it's the same every time, right? That's good. All right. How's everybody doing this morning?
Pretty good. Stayed up too late.
Stayed up too late.
Same.
That's the issue with having young people here. If we had the old guys here today, they'd be like, well, I've been up since 4 this morning. So anyways, Pastor Don this morning went over Isaiah chapter 7. We read through verses 1 through 25, and I just wanted to start out by doing like we always do and just asking initial impressions. What were some initial takeaways? What'd you think? Aubrey, I'll start with you.
I'm glad I don't live in those times. It's kind of the first thing that came to mind. Not that we're not seeing armies or territories moving in or the landscape shifting, but it certainly doesn't change as dramatically as it did before. And there's a little more legality involved beyond, I have a bigger stick than you.
Yeah, that's true. Dylan, what initial thoughts?
I don't know. I thought it was just cool that I guess most of the what I've read in Isaiah has typically been like going back from like the Gospels or something like Matthew or whatever. And like looking back at like a few verses or something, it hasn't necessarily been like put in context a ton for me. Like I know the context of it because I've been in church for years,
right, but, forever.
But just like typically when I see these verses and chapters, it's in the context of like the New Testament instead of like, oh, let's actually talk about it as it, what was going on for the Israelites then, which like growing up in the church, I know that there's kind of like the duality of like, not only was the prophecies about what was happening to Israel, but also about like the Messiah later on. But typically the focus is always on the later on parts. Right. So I think it's interesting to like go back and look at, let's look at the other part of that context. So
it's true. We typically read scripture with the attitude of I'm looking at it and what's in it for me, you know, what is it saying today? How is it affecting the church today? So it's not always, you know, looking at it from the perspective of what were they thinking back then? What was going on back then? How did it affect them back then? And then maybe drawing some parallels as to today.
I can't usually think of a time where you've just, like Dylan was saying, where you've just studied Isaiah isolated as it what it is. It's always like the callback book. You're always referencing it when typically in New Testament, because that's when all of, well, not all of them, but that's when a lot of the prophecies that they were that he was talking about happened. So then it's like it's a way to call back and validate, you know, that this is what's happening. Or so it's typically used that way in churches. It seems like it's not very often that you actually just say let's just look at this book as its own book, what it's saying by itself, kind of thing.
Yeah. Like I like history, and so I enjoy like looking at parallels between historical things and now, but it's also sometimes fun to just like, or sometimes interesting, and you can learn a lot from like, well, what was, let's just look at it in historical context without having to try to constantly tie it back to like things that are currently going on today, you know? Not that we can't do that too, but
you can, but as our hermeneutic and reading scripture, you know, says, we try to understand what the scripture was saying to the people at that time and what was God saying to them and how did that play out in that day And then once you understand that, I think you can maybe draw better parallels as mm-hmm. to what's going on today. I think a lot of times we pull stuff out of context in the Old Testament and try to make it into some application for today. And it doesn't, either it doesn't fit, or when you go back and you actually read what was going on, it wasn't talking about that at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, all right. I think there was some good initial thoughts, some feedback on that. I did see in here that Pastor Don was looking at it, and he did mention the fact that this really isn't a historical account, that we understand that Isaiah was a scribe or a documenter of whatnot of his day, and he probably had volumes of information that was mm-hmm. actual, this conversation, the king said this to this person, that kind of thing. And so we know that that probably existed in his day. We don't have that anymore. It wasn't kept in antiquity. But we do have this account, and I guess where it does touch on history, it's correct. But there's a lot of details missing because mm-hmm. Isaiah wasn't trying to give us a historical account of what necessarily all the ins and outs of what was going on. And so to your point, Aubrey, when you were saying just a few minutes ago about, you know, kind of how it, you see some parallels and things as to how things are going on today. You know, unfortunately, I don't know that we necessarily have a really good understanding of what their life was like back then for the average day-to-day person. Mm-hmm. We're getting a little bit of Isaiah's perspective, and he's dealing with the royalty. He's talking to the kings, mm-hmm. and yeah. the policymakers, the people making decisions. But, you know, for the average Israelite of that day, we don't really know what their daily life was like. I mean, did their life suck, or was it, you know, decent? Were they just living life? We don't know.
Yeah, well, this is kind of odd sense of self-importance that we get to look at the communication between a king and a prophet and go, well, what does that have to do with my life?
Yeah.
If you lived in those days, you'd be herding goats.
Maybe. You might be a business owner, a pottery maker, or whatever. Yeah.
But it would affect you, absolutely, because what a king does and what a prophet says affects you.
Absolutely.
But you weren't contemplating it.
Right.
I don't really think.
You probably weren't too worried about it. Mm-mm. Right. It wasn't part of your, yeah.
And back to what you said about it not being like just a historical overview, you know, it's kind of laid out in like bullet points and highlights. You get a very one sentence that, you know, probably could be expounded on into its own book kind of thing. But in Isaiah, it's just one sentence and then you move on because he's telling a specific story. He has a specific purpose for this writing that has made its way all the way to us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very true. So let's take a look at the account a little bit here in chapter 7. We see that evidently the northern territory that, you know, we referred to as Israel or Ephraim. And Pastor Don talked a little bit about the history of that and why it might be referred to as Ephraim at times in the scripture, but that they were evidently aligning with Syria and were trying to come down and remove the king of Judah so that they could put their own person in power there in order to get what they wanted. So there's a little bit of the politics, I guess, of the day,
mm-hmm.
what was happening at that time. Either one of you guys remember the names of those leaders that came down to attack Judah?
It says here, Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah.
Yeah, Pekah, the son of Remaliah, I guess. Yeah, strange names.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody names their kid Pekah these days. I thought that was kind of interesting that evidently this process or this, tactic of coming in and removing a king and putting your own puppet king in his place was not uncommon.
That they try to do that a lot in like ancient history and stuff. Assassinate the king and replace him, or mm-hmm. get his successor to move up faster. Kind of those seem to happen a lot when you look back at just when there were kings and fighting was always happening.
Mm-hmm.
Dark Ages, yeah. Middle Ages, ancient history.
All the people trying to attach themselves to the first Queen Elizabeth and trying to take over her reign through marriage for the most part with them, beyond just the conflict that she had with her sister Mary, but also, I mean, there was a swarm of powerful men around her who were constantly trying to get her favor and to try and get power over her. She never did let them.
Nope, she was quite the queen. Tough woman.
They don't make them like that anymore.
Probably good.
Yeah, she was pretty amazing. So we got this whole section starting in verse 7 and going through verse 9. And where the God says, it shall not stand, shall not come to pass, for the head of Syria is Damascus. Head of Damascus is Rezin, and within 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered from being a people, and the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Ramaliah. If you're not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. And then he asks Ahaz about the sign. I thought that was kind of interesting. Let it be as deep as Sheol or high as heaven.
You want proof? I'll give you proof. Mm-hmm. Ask me anything and I will make it happen.
Yeah. How often does that happen?
And he wimps out.
And doesn't take it up.
Yeah. You say, how often does that happen? This is probably like the first time that I have seen it in scripture. Like that it doesn't happen.
Right.
Yeah. Normally often. He'll pick something like a pillar of fire or a burning bush or like,
or the people are begging and yeah. asking for some sort of sign.
Right.
It's not the other way around.
Yeah. Tell me what you want. It can be as high as heaven or as deep as Sheol or hell. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you want and I'll do it. And Ahaz says, no.
It's not my place to test the Lord.
Yeah. Which was kind of an interesting phrase. And I think Don took it as sort of, you know, his pride or arrogance, which might be true because, you know, we listened last week. He was talking about the size of his army. Mm-hmm. You know, he had an army of, was it 307,000 men or something like that? It was a huge
300
number.
Something.
Yeah.
350, somewhere in there.
Yeah. It was a huge number of huge army. So, and Jerusalem is one of those places, the reason they moved the capital there, and it was so difficult for David to take over Jerusalem in the first place is because it was well fortified. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of in a hilly area where it was really tough to gain a tactical advantage against the city. And they had built up the walls and everything around it to where the only way you could take Jerusalem was just a siege. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And wait till they, you know, starved or whatever and gave up. So it was difficult. So maybe it was an arrogance thing. He didn't think he really could be defeated, but I just thought it was an interesting phrase, I guess.
Yeah, because it sounds almost like the right answer.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. It kind of has that.
The way it's written, it's like, who am I to test the Lord or whatever? That seems like that would be the right thing to say.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. I'm not worthy kind of thing, but apparently.
Yeah,
it wasn't in the right attitude.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
How he said it.
Humble like, bragging.
Yeah, like it depends on why you're saying that. If you're saying that because your faith in the Lord is mm-hmm. strong and you're like, no, I just trust you, like I don't need to, then that's, you know, one thing. But if you're saying it because it's like, well, my armies are so big and the walls haven't been breached and, you know, whatever, then it's, you know. Well, you're not putting your faith in God. At that point, you're putting your faith in yourself and your armies and man. And so it's like, then it's the wrong answer. So,
and he knows your heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He knows what you mean by it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, God knew where he was coming from. And maybe that's why he offered to him, because he knew he wouldn't take it, you know. Who knows? That's kind of interesting, though. And then he comes back and says, "Hear then, O house of David." And Pastor Don made the note that it's very rare that God would use this kind of phraseology. It's not something he would normally have said. It would normally have been directed at Ahaz, the king himself. You know, because of this, I'm new to you, but to say the house of David, that includes a lot of people, mm-hmm. Not just him. And, you know, since he had already promised that, somebody from the throne of David would be on the throne, it's a pretty major pronouncement, I think. Again, we get some interesting phraseology here again. You know, is it too little for you to weary men that you weary my God also? It's a strange turn of phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this flows better in the Hebrew.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. I mean, it's considered a great literary work, and I can understand that. And, you know, and I think we talked about in one of the chapters, 3 or 4, I can't remember which one it was now, where it's all pretty much a poem. Mm-hmm. And that if you read it in the Hebrew, you would get the kind of rhyming sort of
the flow
to it, because of the words that are chosen and used in it, but you don't catch that in the English. It sounds kind of funny in the English, in the translation.
That response, though, does lead me to believe that his attitude in responding to the Lord's offer of a sign was not the way to go.
Right. Mm-hmm. And not out of any sense of humility.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. So he says, the Lord will give you a sign. And we get the famous verse, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel, you know, mm-hmm. which we all recognize from New Testament, mm-hmm. One of the messianic verses, but that wouldn't have necessarily been taken that way in that time. You know, they may not have understood it to mean that it was messianic in any way.
No, because, well, I mean, I can't speak for them, but do people really think about a big picture when they hear things like that? They're probably right. thinking that he's talking about you, your lifetime, something mm-hmm. that's going to happen right now.
Mm-hmm.
As most people probably would.
Yeah.
They're not thinking that it's going to happen however many years later down the road, that this is a big picture prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if it's being told to you, the human perspective would expect it to happen within your lifetime.
Yeah, and some of the verses that come after that sort of give you the idea that maybe some aspect of it at least was going to happen in their lifetime. You know, when you get down to verse 16, for before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we know that happened, that the Syrians came in and kind of just took everything out in Israel, and Judah was kind of left on their own until they finally got taken out by the Babylonians. So there must have been some aspect of it that would have made sense to their time. It'd be interesting to study that a little more and see what was going on at that time that they might have been able to point to.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see here. In my notes, we have the verses about asking your heart's desire. Verses 14 on, we get the sign from the Lord. And basically, what was the sign? Any of you pick up on that? I mean, obviously, we get the messianic verse, but there's a bunch of stuff after that. What all happened after that?
Is that when he was talking about everything was going to get destroyed and overgrown and mm-hmm. be brambles and
yep.
just only be good for cows and goats?
Yeah, so basically, he was predicting the eventual Assyrian takeover of Israel. Yeah. That the Assyrians were going to come in and just destroy everything, and Siri's trying to talk.
Oh, the Syrian invasion?
Yeah, you got to be careful what you say. So that was kind of funny. So you get
put that at the end of the episode.
Yeah, right. So you get the so I can't say their name because then my phone will try to talk to me. The people to the north of Judah, to the north of Israel,
the Assyrians.
Yeah,
there's no Alexas in here, so you could call them Alexa, I guess.
Yeah, right. But it made me wonder, you know, we see in Jesus' day that Israel was a land, again, under King Herod.
Mm-hmm.
But they had this people group that lived to the north of them. Do you guys remember what their names were?
Was that the end?
No. And nobody in Israel liked these people.
Samaritans.
Because they were a mixed race, right? So maybe when the Assyrians came in and they began doing their thing, when they took out that land, you know, Pastor Don did mention that maybe some of those tribes of Levi had intermarried with
mm-hmm.
with the individual people, the Jewish people of that area, and then they moved south when the split happened, and the Israel tribes began having their false Mosaic tradition or whatever. Because we know in the time of Jesus that the Samaritans who lived north of there, they still considered themselves to be part of the Hasidic people. They were Jewish, but they were had intermarried, and they had different customs than the Israelites did.
Mm-hmm.
So and that's why they weren't liked. That's why, mm-hmm. you know, when they would take a trip, they would go around Samaria to get to the rest of the other part of Israel, because they didn't want to even walk on the land that these people inhabited. That's how much they disliked them. So I'm wondering, I don't know for sure, I'd have to do some more study on that, but if that wasn't part of what happened as part of this, that we had that intermingling of the people groups. Anything else we want to touch on with the past? Was there anything that really stuck out at you that kind of gave you sort of an aha moment? Any thoughts about shaving with a razor?
Yeah, Dylan. Any thoughts about shaving with a razor?
Not yet. Not yet.
Would you be humiliated if we shaved your beard and hair and all that off?
And your feet?
And your feet.
I mean, it's whatever. It's kind of hot down here, so.
It might not be so bad.
Yeah. Like, it might be weird at first, but maybe cooler. You never know.
Yeah, it's not. That's not quite as humiliating in this day and age. People do all sorts of weird stuff with their hair and their bodies and stuff nowadays. So.
That's true. It was an interesting thing, though, and it made me think to some of the, like, Discovery Channel shows and stuff I watched where they've kind of done a history of Syria, mm-hmm. and you see statues and things of the Syrian kings, and they've always got those really long braided beards and, mm-hmm. you know, and the fancy headdresses and everything. And so, you know, maybe it was much, much more of a big deal then for a man to be able to grow that kind of a, you know, strong beard or whatever. It said something about your virility or whatever.
I mean, hair is pretty important in a lot of cultures. You see it in like Native Americans and stuff. They keep the long hair.
And they scalp each other.
Yeah.
It's like a trophy.
Yeah, an extra humiliation. Take somebody else's stuff hair. Like that.
Yeah. Yeah, so we had the thing about the razor, and then we had in that day a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep. There's a lot of individual verses in here that you'd like to know a little more about what's behind that. Mm-hmm. Why is that significant? Why was it mentioned? You know, other than the fact that it just shows how desolated the area was going to be if that's what you had left.
Yeah, just mm-hmm. reading straight through, I don't know that I would have grasped that at all. But Don kind of explaining that was just giving an example of, you know, yeah, what you have left and how few people are around to be able to sustain themselves mm-hmm. off of that. So that kind of helped me understand more of what, you know, what he was trying to say in that. But if I had just read that myself, I'd be like, oh, yep, that's just more strange, you know, symbolism for something. Yeah,
right. Exactly. I'm not sure what that means, but I'll move on. Yeah, so you kind of get this sense that, you know, that the land was going to be really desolate. There wasn't going to be much left. That things like cattle and sheep were just kind of running, roaming wild. That everything had grown over the vineyard, mm-hmm. destroyed. That's very disheartening.
tell me about it.
After all the work that goes into a vineyard. And that it says, with bow and arrows, a man will come there. For all the land will be briars and thorns. So basically everything's a wilderness. It's a hunting ground now. All this area that used to be farmland and mm-hmm. and crops and stuff is just kind of laid waste, which is kind of interesting because you can make some historical parallels even to today when Israel came back to the land. The people groups that were living there before, now that we refer to them as Palestinians, but there were several people groups that were kind of living in that area. And as the Jewish people began moving back in and buying up pieces of property and gradually reconstituting what we know as Israel today, one of the things they did was they began agricultural things, you know, and it's kind of always been the thing that when the Jews are in that land, it seems like the land prospers. And that there is agriculture, there is growth, there is fruitfulness of the land. But when they're not in the land and other people groups are in the land, it's like this. You know, it's grazing, hunting, wilderness kind of area. It's like, you know, why would you want this land, you know, kind of thing. But for some reason, Israel's able to make something out of it.
Probably holding on to very old traditions of caring for the land. The Jewish people are a tight-knit community, and they also have a very strong oral history. Like, they pass information from generation to generation. So if your people were in this land and they knew how to make that land work, that knowledge probably still exists within that community and culture.
One of the things I've always appreciated about Jewish people and Israel in particular is they have it in their Mosaic law and their teachings and their writings. They have this sort of generational approach to things. Mm-hmm. You don't build something for yourself. You build it for two generations down. Mm-hmm. So you're always thinking in terms of when I plant this field, when I build this business, when I build this house, whatever, that I have to build it. I have to plant it. I have to grow this business for two generations down. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of the reasons why Jewish people tend to seem to really do well in business, why they seem to do well in banking, why they, you know, because they've got this long-term sort of generational approach. They're not thinking short-term. Mm-hmm. They're not thinking the next quarter. So it makes a difference. It makes a huge difference. All right. Anything else you guys wanted to discuss or talk about as far as the message goes? I thought it was a good message. I thought the stuff that Pastor Don talked about at the end was good, was very insightful. Don't want to go into too much detail on that, but we'll hopefully, depending on after editing, how much of it, because there was some good stuff in there I thought that was really insightful. And I thought his whole talking about how the church has lost their voice, I thought that might be something that we could kind of expound upon a little bit. I think he's right. You know, and it wasn't too long ago that the church seemed to have more influence and voice in not just the political sphere, but in societal sphere. And unfortunately, I think in some ways, I think the church's involvement in the political sphere is what sort of lost them their voice. I think that was kind of the beginning of the end.
Yeah.
When it became political.
Yeah. I don't know that they lost their voice. I think they voluntarily gave it up by their actions and things that they did within political sphere. And
yeah,
I mean, we even saw it today where, you know, sometimes I think we're afraid to talk, you know, like we're dancing around like, oh, we're cutting some parts out. And it's like, mm-hmm. well, no one's forcing us to do that. Like our voice could be out there, but we're voluntarily giving that part of it up because we don't think people will listen, or we don't want to get in trouble, or, you know, whatever it may be.
Yeah, you don't want the internet mob coming after you.
Mm-hmm. I think there's some of that, but I think the other thing is that generally people just don't care either. Like, I think probably a lot of it is because the church got political and then there were so many loud protests and, in my opinion, mishandlings of, like, hot button issues. Mm. Something would happen with the dude from Duck Dynasty, you know, and then all of a sudden on Facebook, all the Christians are outraged and they're sharing things, and then and it turns people off. And so now when if someone does say something like that, or the church says something, like, society as a whole is not looking at that as one of our things we should take into consideration. Like with the whole virus and everything, it's what are scientists saying? What are doctors saying? What is the government saying? Nobody stops and thinks or even cares to look, what is the church saying?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think, like Dylan said, they kind of did that to themselves in a lot of ways. I do agree that, you know, there is the whole, like, we don't want people coming after us and we're kind of censoring ourselves. And I see that aspect, but I see it more as, even if the church still has their voice and they're still saying things, nobody's listening.
Right.
Yeah.
Nobody on the outside cares.
Well, and like you said, you know, as I've been following, you know, the coronavirus stuff and the George Floyd stuff and all of that, most of what I see being said by those purporting to be a voice of the church or something like that isn't really a voice of the church, in my opinion. Oftentimes it is a political voice or a personal opinion that is framed as a voice of the church. But when you dig down into, like, well, what is scriptural, you know, in this, what, you know, is this voice, is what they're saying, you know, like, my first check for it is always like, is this a loving response, or is this something that demonstrates Christ's love? And if, you know, if a response or something that's posted as a voice of the church doesn't seem to even meet that basic criteria, I do question, like, well, is this even, you know, like, I can't just put, you know, these words I'm saying right now are my opinion. They're from me, you know, like, I am a Christian, but I can't purport to speak for the church from that, you know? And a lot of times I think those that do claim to speak from the church, again, are just kind of, I think oftentimes they're not necessarily saying things that line up with what we claim to believe.
Well, and who would even be the representative of that? Like, you have the head of the CDC, you have President Trump, you have figureheads, leaders, people. Mm-hmm. Catholicism has the Pope, and he makes his statements. And once upon a time, the Baptists had Billy Graham. And I believe his son is still out there making
Franklin
statements.
Franklin Graham's out there, but I don't think he has anywhere near the influence his dad had.
No. And so then it falls into these pockets of, you know, whoever the head of, you know, the LDS is making their statements for the LDS. Got Westboro Baptist Church doing whatever the heck they're doing, and I'm glad I don't
have
to.
Are they even still a thing?
I'm glad I don't hear anything from them right. anymore. And I am sure Joel Osteen has put out a statement. I'm sure all the, you know, the televangelists have put out their statements right. and their thoughts and whatnot, but mm-hmm. it's so different. Like, right. we don't believe what the LDS Church believes.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, there's such a fundamental divide and so many different things that, so many different denominations within mm-hmm. the church, that it makes it easy to go, yeah, the church is saying that, but that's not my church. Like, right. the Pope said that, mm-hmm. but we're not Catholic.
But right. even yeah. if you take it down to a more local level, if you say, you know, how many people when the coronavirus started reached out to their local pastor or their local church leadership or whatever and said, what should we be doing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is this true?
Yeah. Right. How should we respond to this?
Yeah, they don't even, like, they just, that's not really something that crosses your mind.
Yeah. You know? Well, and too, I mean, like, we could say, like, okay, there's maybe not a centralized figurehead for the church, but then, you know, that would leave it to the body of Christ, the people of the church, to be kind of giving, like, a message or, you know, kind of all on the same page with things. And the reality is that we're not there either. You know, we're not asked about the coronavirus because, you know, within the church, there's people who don't think it's a big deal. There are people who are taking a lot of precautions and everywhere in between. And so, you know, we're not asked because there's not a, we're all on the same page sort of opinion on it. You know, it's not like we, you know, we can all have our own opinions on, well, this is what I believe the loving thing to do is. And, you know, other people are like, well, this is what I believe the loving thing to do is. And, but we don't have a centralized, you know, like that. I guess that's the thing with like the CDC is they, and science is like, they've been able to sit down and be like, according to what we know and research, this is what we think we should do. And I think that's where maybe we kind of struggle is.
Yeah, well, we give the CDC the benefit of the doubt as being sort of the voice or whatever of the scientific community in that. But even in that community, there are other epidemiologists and whatnot that are saying, no, what the CDC is telling you is not what I would do in this situation or how we should handle this.
Exactly.
They've got their own opinions.
Maybe.
But they don't get the airplay, I guess, is the main thing. You know, everybody kind of refers to the CDC or the WHO as kind of the authoritative voice in that, whereas there really isn't, you don't have that necessarily with churches per se. But I wanted to get to the point that, you know, and I made a note here that the people of God don't know how to respond because of the poor teaching that we get in our churches these days.
Absolutely.
It's become such a social event that we don't, the actual scriptural teaching is pretty light and fluffy for the most part.
There's like 45 minutes of singing and that kind of stuff, feelings.
You got your 25 minutes of singing, and then you got the kids coming up from children's church to do their little thing they've been working on. Right. Then you get a brief little message before we pass a plate, finding the one verse in the Bible that talks about how you should handle your money. And then we pass a plate, and then the preacher goes and does a word search in his Bible for every time they say love. Mm-hmm. And then they cobble together a sermon from that. And then you sing one more song and then you all leave, you know, so you can make it to Cracker Barrel on time.
Right.
Like, at no point in there is there like, I'm modeling this exactly after one of the Baptist churches we attended when we were church hunting when we were at school. But at no point was there any substance at all.
Right.
It was all feely. It was all, you know, maybe this, maybe that. We're doing a study in Hebrews. So here's one verse from Hebrews and then cherry picked verses from the rest of the Bible.
Right.
And it's like,
that has nothing to do with
Hebrews.
Yeah. Right. And it is. I think it's sad. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult and why you're reading through Facebook or whatever, you see people that you know are good Christian people posting stuff that you're like, why are you posting that?
Mm-hmm.
That is so dumb. You know, that is so shallow, that it's so, you know, you're attacking or you're being defensive or whatever. And that's not what scripture has to say about this issue. And it's not the way we should be responding as the church on this issue. And it's a shame, but, you know, again, I think we've kind of done it to ourselves in many ways as overall as the church, if you can put a label on it all. Any other thoughts on that? I mean, voice of the church, where are we at? Where is it going?
I mean,
what's the church need to do to get their voice back, I guess, is the question.
Well, they have to want to. Like you mentioned that a lot of the times we're not getting the teaching we need to be equipped to handle situations, but then do the people coming to church want that? I guess it might thin out the herd a little bit.
Yeah.
If you're not getting your emotional experience and you actually, it's more like
attending a lecture.
Yeah, a lecture or some sort of like, you actually have to think. I don't know. There's lots of thoughts on this. I don't know that there's any like any concrete answers, but.
Yeah, and these are just our random opinions at the moment and may change tomorrow, but just kind of curious. What do you think?
Yeah. I don't know. It's something I struggle with constantly because it's the more, I guess the older I get, the more and more I'm like, I don't even really like this thing that is the church anymore. You know, it's like, I know from growing up and everything, I'm like, I know what it means to be a Christian and I know what Christianity is, but Christianity, at least in our society today, has become a label that means so much more and so many things that I also don't agree with. Yeah. It's become a politicized label. It's become something that is used to justify things that are not, you know, that don't line up with what I understand as Christianity. And so it's, you know, it's almost like, you know, what does the church need to do? It needs to get itself away from what that is. And I don't even know if that's possible with still labeling it as a Christianity church type of thing. You know,
it needs a rebranding.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd like, almost have to redefine what it means to be a Christian.
I don't disagree. I think that would be a good thing
in
a lot of ways.
And just, you know, like, I think, because I think we did this when I was younger, like in middle school or high school, like looking at, like, well, what is church? You know, what is the body of Christ? What is Christianity? What is the church? Because, you know, I think in today's society, most people would be like, oh, well, church is going to church on Sunday. And, you know, that's about the depth of what they think.
I believe Jesus exists.
Yeah. And so I think the more you get into it, the more it's like, well, we don't even know, like we call ourselves the church and we know what we mean when we say the church, but I think a lot of people in today's society don't really understand like what the church is, because that's the whole point of like the New Testament is like the church is the people. It's not the place. It's, you know, it's people who are loving and acting like Jesus. And I think we've kind of shifted to like defining it as the building or this body of, or not this body of people, but like this political term as opposed to like a those people over there, they're Christians and I can tell because of how they act and how they're responding to things and what they're doing. So maybe that's a little bit more of a downer than what you were hoping for, but yeah, the longer I've looked and tried to find churches other places, the more I'm like, I don't know that I can. So,
yeah, it would take a lot of different people with a lot of different ideas on things to come together and get on the same page, first and foremost. If you want to have a voice people can hear, you have to be saying the same thing. And I don't see Christianity as a whole getting on that same page. I could see maybe the different denominations slowly starting to kind of line back up again, having the Episcopal churches all having the same kind of mission statement, having the Baptist churches have all kind of the same mission statement, but we're never going to agree with anything Joel Osteen puts out there.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, it's so different and it's morphed so beyond that someone's either going to have to get really, really, really loud or we're all going to have to get on that same page. And I personally don't see it happening.
Well, and so I have a question too, you know, like we're talking about like, well, what does the church need to do to get its voice back? But I guess the question that I find running through my mind is like, does the church need a voice? Do we need, cause I guess I look at it as like, okay, well, with a voice comes power and with power comes corruption and people who are going to use it for their own personal gains. And so to me, like, when I think about it, like, yes, if our voice was able to communicate, like, be used only for doing things that were in line with scripture and doing things that were loving, then it's like, yes, that's the idyllic dream. But at the same time, I think anytime, even just looking at our government, you know, it's like, okay, maybe when the founding fathers wrote the Constitution, like, yes, that was kind of an idealistic dream, but we've seen over 200 years, it's like, it's become kind of a lot of corruption and a lot of different people using it for personal gain and power. And so that comes with the voice that they have. And mm-hmm. even, yeah. you know, the CDC, like we talked about earlier, you know, in general, we trust them to try to steer us in the right direction, but that's not to say that there aren't people within the CDC or who are trying to use the voice that it has in order to, for personal gain,
right,
you know,
push a certain narrative or whatever.
And so I look at a lot of that kind of stuff and I'm like, well, does the church need a voice? Is that, you know, something that's scriptural, you know, like we as the people, the body of the church individually, yes, maybe we're supposed to use our own voices, but does the church need a big centralized voice or do we find power as an individual?
What if you replace the word voice with like presence or influence?
Mm-hmm.
So like the church as an example or as an influence or as, you know, it has a presence in society that people, maybe the church isn't actively using their, you know, church president to mm-hmm. give out statements on various things going on. But maybe when something does happen, people look to the church and just. Because it exists and it's like, how are these people responding? Cause they're mm-hmm. a little different, you know? So maybe it's not like an outward voice, but just a presence or an influence on
yeah.
that people can look to.
Yeah. Cause I mean, like I said, you know, in that kind of an example where it's like, oh no, something like the coronavirus happens and people seek comfort in the church or seek mm-hmm. help from the church, you know,
right.
like they seek that kind of an influence, then yeah. Like I do think that's definitely a good thing, but I don't know that that comes from a, you know, like let's try to influence the events as they play out sort
right.
of voice, you know, influencer voice. I think to me, I guess what's bouncing around in my mind, again, I'm not speaking for any, this is me, but to me, it seems like it's a, you know, like the people of the church influence things by just being the church and by loving like Christ would love,
mm-hmm.
Because that, you know, if we do nothing but just that, that's going to make a difference. That's going to influence people. And I don't think we necessarily need to be like trying to manipulate or influence events or political candidates or, you know, people within local government or, you know, anything like that. I think just by the nature, I mean, we talked about like King Ahaz being like, well, I don't need a sign. It's like, well, if we're going to put our faith in God, then, you know, just love like Christ loved and put faith in God that he'll kind of work it out and events will happen.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to like, well, we don't need a sign because, well, we're the church. We're going to influence this the way we want it. You know, we're going to try to get this person elected or
right.
we're going to try to influence this.
Shift this policy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, I mean, in a perfect world, like, yes, I think if we were all on the same page and loving like Christ loved, then maybe if everyone was pushing for that, then it could work.
Right.
But at the same time, it's like, I guess I look at scale and I'm like, well, maybe we just need to like start local and just love yeah. like Christ loved and have that shift happen just within our own communities. And then as yeah. it expands even wider.
I don't know that I did a good, like if what I've been taking voice as in this conversation and what Don was saying is more of like a play, like an influence you can look to or turn to, not necessarily a figure.
Yeah.
You know, not like, okay, what is the president, the CDC and the church saying on this, but more like mm-hmm. when something does happen, like after Katrina,
mm-hmm.
the church was there, at least in our yeah. community, and you saw that, whereas you don't really, I don't see that right now.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody thinks of the church as an option.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I'm thinking of as a voice or a presence, not mm-hmm. necessarily that we all have to we all have to come together, have a big old meeting, get on the same page, and decide this guy is going to now announce how we feel on these topics. The yeah. It's more like the church just seems more irrelevant now, even in my lifetime, than it did when I was younger. And like when Katrina happened and we had a catastrophe in the church, we had volunteers from churches all over the country coming out to help. And we had our church was like a hub for the community where people were coming and eating and you know, there was services and that isn't happening anymore right now. And I get like that was a very localized event.
Yeah.
And this is a lot more broader and we're not feeling effects like that. But you still don't really hear about it.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like the church has that relevance or presence even, you know, 10 years later.
And yeah. It is kind of tricky because we may not be hearing about it, but we don't know what the churches in, say, Tampa, Florida are doing because they're an area that's been largely affected. Or with the protests and in some places it turning into a riot, like what are the local churches there doing? Right. Obviously, the media doesn't want to talk about
that. Yeah, that's not
a media story. Yeah, it's not pushing their narrative of a conflict. And only
it's too
so
happy
many,
and uplifting.
Yeah, only so many local stories get circulated within social media and the like. And again, people are still pushing agendas. But yeah, I think if the church wants a presence and wants to be a place that people can turn to, they have to make themselves a place people can turn to.
Right.
Like when the flooding happened in Houston, I'm going to pick on Joel Osteen again. His church was turning people away.
Right.
Yeah.
They weren't letting people take shelter there. They weren't coordinating any kind of relief efforts. Like they were showing their true colors. So it, you know.
Yeah.
He's not a good voice, or it's not a good presence. It's not a positive influence in the community.
I agree with that. And I think that after the riot goes through your town or whatever, it should be the church that's in there trying to help people clean out their stores and get rebuilt and get back on their feet again and providing assistance where they can and helping folks.
And I think that's
that kind of thing. And
those should be the voice
the church should be doing.
Yeah.
What I wanted to say though on all this, and maybe we were asking the wrong question, you know, as far as the church's voice and does the church have a voice and what do we need to do to get our voice back? I mean, because what is the church's mission? The church's mission isn't to have a voice. The church's mission is to spread the gospel, to make disciples. And if you do that well, the rest of it kind of takes care of itself.
Yeah.
Because you're teaching those things. People are becoming Christians. They're learning about scripture. They're learning what it means to disciple others. And it becomes this exponential, almost like a multi-level marketing scheme kind of thing where, you know, eventually you
except
on a good level, right? There's no money involved, right?
But
that's the idea is that this should spread and grow. And as people understand things like sanctification and what that means to their lives and walking with the Lord and walking in the Spirit and teach that to others, a lot of these issues we have and even issues within the church, I think, would largely take care of themselves. And when you would get those occasional bad apples, everyone would look and go, ooh, that's a bad apple. You know,
and
they
you
wouldn't
could
be
recognize
let
us, them
right,
better.
They wouldn't be led astray by that so easily.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, because I think that really gets at maybe what's almost the core of the problem of the church having lost their voice is that people don't feel like they can go to the church. You know, like you, like Andrew was saying, you know, it's like you don't feel like people look to the church. You don't feel like it's a part of that narrative. Right. And it's not necessarily, you know, like there's definitely churches and people that are doing these things and we just don't hear about them.
Right.
But by and large, I think in the, you know, the grand scheme of things, most people just don't think of the church as the place to go to get help or to get those things.
And people's mind share, it's not there.
And
it is and it isn't. I keep thinking, though, at some point when the rapture occurs and the church is actually taken out, there will be a huge hole in society. And people will suddenly understand really how much the church was actually doing behind the scenes and in the background that we just didn't recognize.
Well, I think part of that's going to be the loss of individuals who are in their workplaces, who are in their communities, who do stuff, who do live a Christ-like life, and their absence is going to be felt because you didn't realize they were doing all the grocery shopping for so-and-so, or they were just like, I don't know. People ask me at work, like the residents ask me all the time, like, oh, you must be so sick of dealing with me, or I'm sorry about this, or how are you so upbeat all the time? And it's only until they ask me like that that I'm like, well, I got Jesus and he keeps me going. And when people like that are gone, it will be felt.
Absolutely.
People will notice.
I was
going to
say, that's the main way I think people will know is that, you know, those folks that they came and complained to and would listen to them and try to help them and counsel them, those folks are gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's where I think that's really where it's going to hurt, where it's going to be felt.
Yeah. Which is kind of a background underground kind of thing, like you were saying.
Which I think is a, I think is an important role for the church. I think we kind of were asking the wrong question as far as the voice of the church, you know, looking at those Billy Graham type figures.
That's not really how I took it, but I think we did kind of get off on that track a little bit.
We think we kind of tend to want to go down that road. And I think it's good though to talk about it and discuss it to clarify, you know, that really the mission of the church is to make disciples. And if we're doing that well, everything else takes care of itself.
Yeah, it's the church as the building, which is what people think of, like Dylan was saying, is like that's where you go to get your tools, to get equipped, to go back out into the world, and that's where you're supposed to be the church.
Yeah.
You're supposed to be building each other up and, you know, kind of hyping each other up and helping each other out when you meet and then going back out and taking it with you.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's been flipped and been kind of lost in general. You know, people don't really come to the church for that reason anymore. It's like you said, it's social or it's to make me feel good or whatever.
Right. They need that emotional charge to get them through their tough week, their horrible week and their awful life or whatever it is they're dealing with. And
where they go back out and they carry that. I hate my life. I hate what I'm doing. I hate the people I work with. This all sucks. And it's the only bright spot is when I can sing that one happy little praise and worship song.
Right.
Like.
Right. Yeah. It's we just do. Kind of, you're right, Andrew. We have it so upside down.
It's it's just kind of flipped and you know, there we go. We solved it.
Right.
But
all you got to do is do it.
And it's simple, but not easy. Right.
Yeah.
And it's, and especially like you guys have all said, it needs to start on a community level and then it just grows from there. And I mean,
yeah. Well, and it requires us to be more present in our current lives too and pay attention to, you know, like a lot of these things that are bubbling up, you know, coronavirus, the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, like these aren't things that, like, I mean, coronavirus kind of just popped up, but these aren't things that just kind of haven't been an issue for, you know, like diseases and stuff have been an issue and, you know, people have been oppressed forever and the church has been kind of sleeping on it a little bit. And, you know, it takes us being aware of it. It takes us taking action with it. It takes us maybe doing things that are hard, you know, and, you know, there's a lot out there that I think is, you know, like you were kind of saying, Andrew, it's easy to just kind of go in and check the box of like, oh, I've gone to church and then, you know, you leave. But like you were saying, the church is more about like you go be the church the rest of the week. And that means like, okay, we've got to actually like work to love and make changes, you know, like
it's the hard part.
If stuff in the community is wrong, that means giving up some of our time to go do it. If, you know, people are getting sick, maybe that means inconveniencing ourselves a little bit to protect others, you know, like it, like back these things up with our actions and, you know, show that love.
Yeah. Pastor Don talks about that a lot, that idea of coming alongside and trying to see where the need is at and then see where you can maybe fit in and come alongside somebody and help them in that instance to kind of get through. We can't fix the whole problem, but maybe if we can work with one or two people and kind of help them through it and help them, you know, see where God fits into this in their lives, I think we'll begin to make a change, make a difference. I'm thinking about, you know, the Upper Room. It was kind of fun initially talking about some of the new stuff because the coronavirus was the big deal, but you know, now looking at sort of the news cycles and the kind of garbage they're talking about, it's like, other than maybe discussing what a Christian response might be in some of these situations, I don't see a lot of value in it. Because really, I think what we talked about today is probably more important for people who are listening to this podcast and trying to figure out where they fit into all this, learning that they are not only a disciple, but they need to be discipling others and teaching these kind of things and propagating this sort of thinking and getting out of the political sphere and the infighting and all that kind of stuff is probably the most beneficial thing that we could do at this point. So I'm hopeful that this will begin maybe being part of something that'll be part of the Upper Room, that we can maybe talk a little more in depth about some of this kind of stuff and maybe give people some guidance. You know, it's easy to say what the church shouldn't be doing or what they shouldn't be involved in, but what should we be doing then?
Yeah. You know,
how should we? And while we can say we need to be teaching people how to do the loving thing and that kind of thing, and that's great, but we need some practical, okay, what does that look like?
Yeah.
That's the thing Don always asks.
Okay, yeah.
What does that look like?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's where we need to kind of maybe spend some more time on that.
Yeah.
So.
And some soul searching too, you know, like it's one thing to say like, oh, we need to do this, but it's like, well, what ways are we failing to do this? You know, like acknowledging where we slip up and fail and, you know, like, oh, okay.
There's always room for improvement.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You can't fix something that's broken if you never acknowledge that it's broken in the first place.
Yep.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you guys being on the Upper Room today and spending some time kind of just sort of, I don't know, throwing stuff against the wall, really.
Trying to see what sticks.
Yep.
It was a good conversation.
Yeah, it was.
It was a good one. Dylan, would you close us out in prayer, please?
Sure.
Thanks.
Father, thank you for this day. Thank you for the things you've given us. I pray that you would continue to help us to demonstrate your love to those in the communities around us and to be the church, to become the people that, you know, communities come to and look at as, you know, looking for you really, and that we can point you in that direction or point them in your direction. And I pray that you would be with people during this time, of unrest, and that again, you would just help us to demonstrate your love to those.
I hope you enjoyed our discussion today and found it thought-provoking. The Upper Room is a Bible Fellowship Church production. The opinions discussed by our guests are just opinions and random thoughts at the time of recording and do not necessarily reflect the doctrine or stated beliefs of Bible Fellowship Church.